at times is becoming farcical. And you have to really feel for these players and management. This isn't normal in any shape or form.
For your first chance to hear Brian O'Driscoll on OTB, download the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications.
The OTB Podcast Network.
So Callum Robinson was in the press conference yesterday, and it was, I think, fairly obvious that he hadn't been vaccinated from the way the conversation went last time around when he was unavailable for part of the first part of the last international window. When you think that he probably would have got into the team, would have started considering he was a striker in form. Here's what he had to say about vaccinations in the press conference yesterday. Have a look.
Say everyone should be vaccinated, or you shouldn't get vaccinated. I think it's your personal choice. If you want to be vaccinated, then go do it. But if you don't want to, it is what it is. It's everyone's choice. I can't tell people to get it, and I can't tell people not to.
Dave,
what's your personal choice, Connor? Have you decided to get vaccinated?
I haven't been vaccinated yet, no. So that's my choice at this moment in time.
Some people might think that's unusual, given your own personal health experiences.
Yeah, of course. As I said, it's obviously annoying that I've caught it twice, but I haven't been vaccinated. Further down the line, I could change my mind and want to do it, but at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated, no.
Dan, do you mind if I ask why you didn't do that?
I just haven't done it. I think, as I said to you, man, here, it's your personal choice, and my choice at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated. I know, as you said, there's managers and people that will want you to do it, which is right in their way of what they think, but everyone has their choice and what they want to do. I wouldn't force it on people to do it or not. It's your choice, it's your body, and what
you want. Do you think you lost caps because of
it?
Could you well avoid the second one?
Well, the first ones, I'm not sure if I could have even had the vaccination last year. So obviously I missed the two. I think I played one. I played the Serbia away. Slovakia away, sorry. And then there was close contact. And then I actually caught it against just before the England friendly. And I missed three games. But I've obviously definitely lost caps through the Corona, because of the coronavirus, it's obviously so annoying that a virus can take away caps from you. But
if the second time you get that vaccinated, there'll be a huge percentage of chance of you not getting it the second time. Do you realise, like, the most recent time?
What, on the other month?
Yeah, if you were vaccinated, you wouldn't have, like,
heard of it. Yeah, I know. But that, as I said, that was my choice. I haven't been vaccinated, and that's where I'm at the moment. As I said, if things might change, where I think, yeah, I want to get vaccinated, I'm going to do it, but at this moment in time, I haven't made that decision. At the moment, I'm not, no.
So that's the press conference yesterday. Nathan, good morning to you, how are you? I guess it's frustrating for Stephen Kenny that this is still an issue when, as Callum Robinson points out, it did cost him the opportunity to play for his country.
Well, Callum Robinson said it's annoying that he missed that second run of fixtures because of picking up COVID for a second time. It's not annoying. There's a certain inevitability about it if you're refusing to get the vaccine. And it may not be the last time that he ends up missing Republic of Ireland internationals. And we should think back to this time a year ago. A lot has gone wrong for Stephen Kenny since he got the Republic of Ireland job. But COVID, for the first 3-4 months, denied him the opportunity to get any momentum. Think back even to the minutes before the game over in Slovakia, and Adam Ida and Aaron Connolly being ruled out of the match. And then they end up in a situation where there's 14 players from an original squad at one stage missing because of COVID-related issues. So for those of us who have been vaccinated, and everyone around them has been vaccinated, I think it's very hard to understand the reasoning behind this. But we just have to look at the statistics, where they still reckon under 50% of Premier League footballers aren't vaccinated.
Yeah.
And is that because they've weighed up the possible effects of testing positive for COVID against the possible effects of getting a vaccine?
Well,
are they anti-vaxxers and in their own little bubble where they don't see anything else? They're only talking to the same people of similar mindset. They don't see anything on social media that doesn't feed into their personal way of life, and they don't see it the way we see it, as straightforward a decision as it was for most people.
It has to be the second of those two options, doesn't it? Because you've got some clubs in the Premier League who are operating at sub 30% vaccination rate, and then you've got Jurgen Klopp coming out the other day to say that Liverpool are at 99% vaccination rate. So this is not an all footballers situation, or because they are professional athletes they are making this decision. This is a culture thing, right?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Is it that certain dressing rooms have loudmouths?
That's what I mean.
Yeah, like and that actually they're a fairly easily led group one way or another. So Man United, the back page of the London Times this morning, are among the Premier League clubs still trying to persuade a number of their teams. They're not believed to be the outliers. There's two outliers who have 20% of their squads, but Manchester United are kind of around the 50% apparently. That's one of the figures that's suggested there. So look, I don't know, the bit where it's like my body, my choice, you know, I see the stealing of the language that they're doing there. I see I see where that comes from. But in this instance, that's not actually a reason. So he was asked why, and it was like, well, I just haven't. Like, I haven't because I got information from this source and this source and this source, and I'm concerned about this, 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 and this. And if that conversation happened, and in fairness, maybe a press conference is not the most natural place to do that and to have that kind of back and forth, but at least then you'd know what you're dealing with. At the moment, it's just like, well, it's my choice. I get to decide on this thing. It's like, okay, well, all the people who decided not to get their kids vaccinated against measles, and now measles is making a comeback. Like, vaccination really only works if there's a collective decision made that we're going to go this direction because it's for our collective benefit. The other thing is that, like, there have been cases of fairly severe injury or illness that athletes have been more prone to than the general population. Myocarditis is one of those conditions that is being linked with athletes who go back after having had COVID. Something to do with the quality of oxygen getting to the air of high performance athletes. There are a few cases of it, but there are a few cases of it in the US in particular. Like, it would be good to know what information the people who are making these decisions are getting, so that you can at least have a conversation about it.
I think you're right. I think there is there are loudmouths in a dressing room who probably are straight out and are reading online and reading what the anti-vaxxers are saying and spreading it and putting doubt into the mind of other players, and then they end up in that same little bubble, and they're reading that, and we know the way that social media works, that once you start reading it, you're probably not going to see anything else. But you would have hoped that they would respect and listen to the team doctors at club level enough, who have to be encouraging them to get this. But it's clearly not getting through, and from what I understand, Callum Robinson isn't the only member of the Republic of Ireland squad who's tested positive for COVID. Like, there are quite a few players in this squad, I think Stephen Kenny said he thinks it's single figures, who haven't been vaccinated. Like, it's that lack of respect it feels for the other people that you're around, that you've made the decision. Like, it does reduce transmissibility if you are vaccinated. Like, there are lots of people around every club squad, every international squad, who I'm sure in ways are immunocompromised, who I'm sure in ways are in the age group where it's far more dangerous to them than it is to young, fit and healthy footballers. And just think about that for a minute. Just pause, think about it and go, actually, I'll just get this for the betterment of everybody around me. I will take whatever risk is in my head, whatever tiny risk it is. But when you have players who've tested positive twice, and what Callum Robinson was saying second time was, you know, was sick from this.
He had chest issues.
That even still after that, he didn't think, you know, I wouldn't like to get this again. You're fighting a bit of a losing battle with some of these players. And I don't know what Stephen Kenny can do. Like,
well, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because he said that he thinks it's too radical to not pick players who haven't been vaccinated. And, like, in a way, if we were England or Brazil or Italy and we had millions and millions of players and there was a cohort who were unvaccinated and they were deciding that actually they were putting themselves ahead of their team, then you wouldn't pick them. But in this instance, we don't have the strength and depth to go, I'm making this decision, I'm taking this stand. Or do we? Is that actually what we should do? I mean, when the asterisk beside Stephen Kenny is and his record is like, oh, well, actually, he went through the COVID era and he couldn't pick some of his players because they weren't vaccinated. And it's like, next manager comes in. Do you know, like, what do you do living in the real world?
I don't think it's a fair comparison either, because England are selecting players who haven't been vaccinated for COVID. Brazil are selecting players. In fact, we're probably going to find out a little bit more over the next few weeks because of the red list countries in the UK and players who may have to isolate if they're not double vaccinated as to who has and hasn't been. So if we look at the Premier League and it's 50%, you'd have to assume the England squad is more or less 50% as well. And Gareth Southgate is picking all those players. So I don't think it comes down to, well, can we risk leaving out Callum Robinson because he's not vaccinated? I think he's just looking at it purely from what Stephen Kenny sees as an ethical point of view. Can I force players to do anything? And clearly feels he can't. I wonder legally, can he force players to have a vaccine to be in a Republic of Ireland squad? But the way around this is probably what is going to happen is that life will become so difficult for those players who aren't vaccinated. We saw with the under-21 squad that Jim Crawford's basically had to name a couple of squads because of red list and telling the young players, if you're not vaccinated, there's a very good chance you're not going to be able to play for Ireland in a lot of these fixtures because you won't be allowed travel. So maybe that is the way around this, is that there will be restrictions on travel for players who haven't been double vaccinated, and that will rule out a lot of players. But will that change their point of view? It doesn't sound like it.
Probably not. Like, I wonder if it, like, the real difference is actually just going to come at club level, because these are the people who employ these players, and it might get to a stage where those players suddenly aren't earning their full wages as a result of not being fully vaccinated, as we're starting to see in the United States at the moment, and that potentially is the next step in this. I think for Stephen Kenny, I think that he would take a stand that a lot of other managers aren't taking, that pretty much every other manager isn't taking at the moment, to leave out a player who hasn't been fully vaccinated. Given his competitive record so far, that is a bridge too far for Stephen Kenny. And can we accept that sort of that slight hypocrisy where, of course, Stephen Kenny is pro-vaccine and wants all his players to be vaccinated while still playing someone like Callum Robinson? I think we can. I think we can get over that. And I think we're in this very complicated situation now where maybe over these next couple of weeks and months, it becomes a more defined thing where that 30% gets much higher in the Premier League, and all of a sudden it is the vast minority of players who aren't vaccinated. And then you can start having conversations about not being paid for not appearing because you're going to start missing games or whatever. So I think that conversation might come down the line, but maybe that's an optimistic view.
What's happening in the NBA?
Well, in the NBA right now, like, I mean, there's two different conversations. The first one is the lack of speaking out about the vaccines. There's a huge slice of disappointment with LeBron James for not speaking out on this and saying that he's essentially peddling the line. It's your body, you can do whatever you want with it, despite the fact that obviously he spoke out quite a bit last year when there were social justice issues. Of course, a very different scenario, but there is a big difference this year compared to last year when it was a political conversation. What you have is Kyrie Irving, who cannot train in New York at the moment, cannot play in New York at the moment, will miss stretches of home games because he's not fully vaccinated. The law in the city right now means that you cannot play there in an indoor setting if you're not jabbed at least once, and he has been hesitant to get his vaccine, so one of their highest paid players will not be able to play as a result of his vaccine status. Steve Nash, their head coach with the Brooklyn Nets, has said that we're not thinking of moving our games or our practices outside of Brooklyn just yet, which is just a bizarre conversation to be having at this point. You've got someone like Andrew Wiggins, who we mentioned on the show earlier on as well, who was one of the bigger voices of not getting the vaccine. He says he's been forced to get the vaccine. Steve Kerr came out over the weekend and said he's got his jab. Andrew Wiggins has come out and said, I was forced to get it and I hope I don't have any health issues in 10, 12 years' time. So there is still that view out there. And however, despite that, there are players who are kind of succumbing to maybe a bit of pressure that they're feeling and getting the vaccine. So that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering, does the UK and Ireland follow suit over the next couple of months? Now, the NBA is at a 95% vaccination rate. So it is the 5% that are grabbing the headlines. Whereas in the Premier League, what is it, well over 50%. It's a completely different scenario at this point.
Yeah. I mean, obviously something has seeped into the culture where these conversations are happening, and they are, you know, maybe Facebook going down for 24 hours was the window for everybody to get in and go, hey, by the way, did you know the vaccine's actually good for you? You'll be grand. Who knows? So maybe footballers aren't using it. Is there anti-vaxxers on TikTok?
I think there's everything on TikTok. Like the thing with this story as well is that, like, I mean, maybe Callum Robinson deserves a little bit of credit for like actually being honest about it. But I do think
I'd give him much more credit if he said these were the sources. This is what I'm worried about. These are my concerns, as opposed to my body, my choice. Because that's just like it ain't none of your business. And fair enough. But like, if you don't get picked or if you miss games, then you're not as good a teammate as you could be. And you put yourself in this scenario, because there are special rules for those who are vaccinated in terms of being a close contact. And you know, if you're a close contact and you test negative but you've been double jabbed, away you go. Life is normal. But not if you haven't been.
Yeah. Like, and I think
I don't want to read too much into his tone. It didn't sound as though he felt as if this was a massive deal that he hadn't been vaccinated. Didn't seem to be making that connection between the fact he had tested positive a second time and not had the vaccine. But I think a huge part is footballers and that bubble and not a full understanding of what's happening, even going all the way back to a year ago. And I know Stephen Kenny didn't want to criticise, but the two players who moved seats on the plane on the way to Slovakia, even that sort of relaxed attitude of, oh, we're in this bubble, we're meant to be separate from everyone else, but does it really matter that much? Yes, it does. Every little thing matters that much. So I don't think we should have any great sympathy for any of these players and any of the hassles that they're going to have over the coming weeks and months, whether it's missing games, whether it's issues with their clubs. Like, this is a decision that they have made on their side, and they're going to have to deal with the consequences.
And that point that you made earlier on, Nathan, as well, I think it's that quote, the sort of, it's so annoying that a virus can take away caps from you, is the thing that people will take away from that and lose sympathy for him immediately. It's almost reminiscent of that Eric Andre sketch where he turns around and shoots Hannibal Buress and is like, who shot Hannibal? It's like, who's to blame for this? And it's like, your decision to not get vaccinated is probably why there have been caps taken away from you. It is something. That quote, for me, is the thing that will lose sympathy with a lot of people when they look at the Callum Robinson quote. And as you say, Nathan, the tone of the piece plays into that completely.
Eric Andre Hannibal Buress.
Yeah. Is this the anti-travelling Wilburys? It's the reverse travelling Wilburys.
You know,
anybody over the age of 34 is like, what?
it's a well-used meme on the internet in our brave new world of meme use. You know, he turns around and shoots the guy and is like, who shot Hannibal? There is this sort of confusion within Callum Robinson's tone about, it's so unfair and it's a bit unfortunate that somebody can take away caps from you because of a virus. And it's like, there is one solution to that. There is one very obvious solution to that unfortunate annoyance.
I'm googling the meme now. Oh, okay, I get it. All right.
Great content.
Quality.
We haven't talked about the actual match and the importance of these games. And maybe this is exactly what we needed, 24 hours of us talking about this while in the camp they're actually... well, hopefully Callum Robinson looks at the back pages and is inspired to put his best foot forward this weekend, score a couple of goals and get a couple of victories for the Republic of Ireland. What would an acceptable level of outcome be from this doubleheader here, Nathan?
Oh, I don't think the Qatar match would be of any great importance, but I think a win in Azerbaijan is a must. They are the minnows of this group, or they should be the minnows of this group. And I think Ireland can't afford, certainly against Azerbaijan, possibly against Luxembourg, to drop points against either of them. Stephen Kenny needs a win. He needs a win. He will see out the end of this campaign. He'll be in charge against Portugal next month and against Luxembourg. I've no doubt about that. But does he get that contract extension? I think they have to beat Azerbaijan and get a respectable performance level. I think Callum Robinson has been a huge loss. I think he could be an absolute key player and should have been a key player for Stephen Kenny over the last year. When he's played, when he's been fully fit, he's been exceptional. He's had that attacking threat that Ireland have lacked at times. So I think if Robinson is fit, he should play. And actually having a front three of Adam Ida, Aaron Connolly and Callum Robinson, you know, I think could carry quite a bit of threat from an Irish point of view. But like, this is the usual build-up to Republic of Ireland squad that we had last month, where it goes under the radar a little bit. We're all talking Liverpool, Manchester City, and by Sunday, Monday, if things don't go well, we're discussing the entire future and everything that's happened over the last 20 years of Irish football. And I wouldn't be surprised if something similar, but I just think they need a win. I think it's as simple as that. Any sort of win means at least you know, the results conversation stops for a little while. I don't think Qatar is massively important.
Okay, there's no real, up till now we've had significant injuries. There are some injuries, okay, obviously Seamus Coleman is out, Darryl Shea is out. But notwithstanding that, we should still have enough against Azerbaijan.
Absolutely, absolutely. Azerbaijan are a far weaker side than Luxembourg are. So I don't think Ireland, even away from home, if they can get where they were the first 10-12 minutes at home against Azerbaijan, I think they'll have far, far too much for them. Like, this is not a side, even going to Baku, I don't think it's the most frightening place to go for a match where the atmosphere is so intense that the players won't be able to cope with it. I think they got to go and show away from home, where they've done relatively well away from home. I think throughout Stephen Kenny's time in charge, the better performances have been away from home. I think they just go away and you win this game 2-0, 3-1, and start to build a little bit of momentum. They'd be, you know, three games unbeaten then in the group, get a win against Qatar in the friendly, and then pray to God you can do something similar against Portugal. But like, there's still enough quality. Seamus Coleman's a massive loss. I have thought he might suddenly appear. He was back doing some individual training with Everton at the end of last week, but he just seems to have these constant niggles at the moment that mean he's out for 2-3 weeks at a time. So maybe it was just too much of a risk. But it means Matt Doherty will just slot into that position. They have Enda Stevens back, who can play at left wing back, presuming they go with a three again. And Andrew Onwuamadele steps in for Darryl Shea, as he did that night against Portugal. You have to win these games. I am fully behind the Stephen Kenny project, the future, the building, the opportunities, the transformation in what Irish football should be about. But I think at a base level, you still have to beat Azerbaijan, home or away. And I think you really need to be beating Luxembourg as well.
Okay. The Qatar game, Damien Delaney reckoned last night on the show, was actually important in terms of mood music, atmosphere around the team, confidence. I can see the point. I can see the point of the benefit that the team got from beating the Faroe Islands.
Andorra.
Andorra. Sorry, another mighty minnow. That actually,
I think Qatar is important if they don't win on Saturday. If they win on Saturday, and if you lose 3-0 at home against Qatar in front of 10,000 people at the Aviva, there's going to be a problem, and these things can happen. But I think if they beat Azerbaijan, I think the importance of Qatar is nullified somewhat.
Okay. What's your starting front three for the game as things stand, knowing what we know, who's available and who's not available?
I would like to see Adam Ida, Aaron Connolly and Callum Robinson as a starting front three.
Okay. Give me your middle three.
I'm trying to go through the team in my head. So I'm going with the back three of Shane Duffy, John Egan, Andrew Omabemadele, Darren Randolph and...
No, Bazunu.
Sorry, Sarah Randolph. Bazunu in goal. Enda Stevens left back, Matt Doherty right back. And then I'd only have two in midfield after that, of course. So you're probably going with Josh Cullen and Jeff Hendrick in the middle of midfield.
Okay.
Fresh off his goal scoring exploits.
Then Robinson and Connolly just in front, either side of Adam Ida.
Okay.
Quality.
Quite attacking. For a team with five at the back, it's quite attacking. Okay, all right.
That's what you want. Go, win this game.
Yep. It would be good to win this game. it would be good for everybody if we could start talking about the football and breaking down how we do win these games and how we build on it so far. So.
I'm sorry, I think that will be more or less the team unless he decides to not play one of Robinson or Connolly and put in an extra midfielder, maybe play Jamie McGrath or Jason Knight in midfield.
How is Jason Knight looking? I haven't seen him since he's been back from
injury. He's been injured. So they've obviously decided he's fit enough to come into this squad, and Stephen Kenny clearly has a lot of time for Jason Knight. Whether he's ready to trust him in here, it might be a little bit too soon, but obviously Malumbi isn't there either, so you'd have to think McGrath is probably the favourite. But I just think if we could get into a rhythm of playing Robinson, Connolly and Ida, that there is enough quality there that against most teams they'll cause them a lot of problems.
Okay, if anybody wants to get in touch this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. You can leave a comment in the YouTube stream, or of course you can tweet us at OffTheBallAM. We should talk about this bubbling story around Mo Salah about how he's not appreciated enough by the Liverpool fans. So the Liverpool fans obviously responded to this by saying, well, yeah, actually I absolutely love Mo Salah more than anything. But is there a case that maybe Mo Salah was like slightly taken for granted? The level of quality, the goal scoring, the rate at which he has established himself as one of the best footballers in the world, while we were constantly listening to people falling over themselves, telling us how great Bobby Firmino was and how important he was to that front trio, and how Sadio Mane was probably almost as good, if not better, sometimes than Mo Salah. It turns out there's a clear pecking order. There's a hierarchy here, and Mo Salah is top of the tree by a significant bit.
Mo Salah's probably top of the tree by a significant bit in the Premier League, right, and how he's at that level. And yeah, there was a lot of looking at the qualities of Firmino and Mane and playing down the quality of Mo Salah. And I think you go to Anfield, Liverpool fans adore Mo Salah. They sing the songs, they do all of that. But he is a player who can frustrate at times in that he's always trying something. So quite often he gives the ball away. And Anfield, it doesn't take a lot for a lot of moans and groans to start around the stadium. And that is down that right wing. Alexander-Arnold can give the ball away quite a lot. Salah can give the ball away quite a lot. But it's because they're always trying to make something happen. And I think that maybe fed into a feeling at times, certainly last season that, and the season before, that maybe Mo Salah wasn't fully on top form, that he wasn't doing it all the time. But the thing that stands out for Salah for me, and I was tweeting this the other night, is the games that he does it in, the goals that he scores against all the best teams in the league, he is the one that delivers again and again. And that goal he scored against Manchester City at the weekend, he scored 5-6 times from that exact same position. And that probably sums up maybe the decline from that first season in terms of goals from 32 down to 22. People copped on. Defences copped on to Mo Salah pretty quickly. Look at that goal against Manchester City. Look at the goal he scored against Everton a couple of seasons ago, against Tottenham, against Watford. All of them. There's 4 or 5 defenders right in on top of him. Every time Mo Salah gets the ball, the left back is out, the left winger is back helping out, the left side of midfielders across as well, because everybody knows the damage he can do. Yet still, in the vast majority of games, he finds a way through them. So I think he's probably the most respected player in the Premier League by defenders because of what he can do. And he continues to just find a way through it. And like the quality of the run for the first goal and the quality of the finish for the second goal, I think probably silenced any questions there'll ever be about Mo Salah again. His record, first, he's played in 4 seasons over 200 games for Liverpool. So he's always there. He rarely, if ever, misses a match. And his goal scoring record is well over 1 and 2. It's, you know, almost probably 2 and 3 at this stage for Liverpool. So like, it is that, what does love mean in terms of football? Is he Robbie Fowler? Like, do they call him God? No, but I don't know in modern football if there'll ever be another Robbie Fowler type figure. I don't know. Like, does that figure exist at other clubs?
Well, I guess if a goal scorer emerges at 17 from the local area, that could happen, right? The odds on that happening now are much smaller because the scouting systems, all that kind of stuff, and also economic deprivation around stadiums seems to be much worse now even than it was in the 80s in Toxteth, and that was about as bad as it got. So I don't know. It's hard to see anybody ever reaching those high heights again at 17, 18 the way that Robbie Fowler did. But it's not impossible. I mean, if Phil Foden was a goal scorer and he'd come through that system, but even then, it's not the... It needs to be at a club like Liverpool, right? It needs to be at like a super club. It needs to be like.
But Fowler was the mix of God and a cult hero, because not only did he have that talent, that local personality, there was also something else to Robbie Fowler. There was a bit of a messer. There was a bit of
snorting the line.
You could latch on to all of that. Whereas the modern footballer, there's very few of them with that sort of personality. Like Cristiano Ronaldo would be the obvious comparison in the love that is there, but I think that's the fact that he came back, much like Fowler came back to Liverpool in 2006, that that bond that is there is just exploded because he came back home again. But it doesn't feel like there's a huge amount of players who get the love of the players of the 90s. Now, maybe again, the kids of today would differ.
Well, let's narrow this down to Premier League era, because obviously Kilkenny is Kilkenny and he's the king. There's many gods, there's only one king. To butcher the Romario line, where in the pantheon of Liverpool greats, and we're talking here, so Premier League era, that, I mean, Michael Owen doesn't get a mention anymore because he signed for Man United, but he did win a European Footballer of the Year as a kid for Liverpool. I would argue Fernando Torres helps to re-establish Liverpool as a global force by signing for them when he does sign for them, and the quality of football that he puts in for a couple of years, which makes it easier for them to sign a Luis Suarez, who obviously then hits even higher heights in some ways than Torres did. And then you've got Mo Salah. So give me a quick power ranking there, Nathan.
Jeez, it's an incredible thing what they've done over the last 13, 14 years to go straight from Torres to Suarez to Salah to consistently have that brilliant goal scorer. I think Salah is top of that list because of the fact he has brought Liverpool a Champions League and the league title, and the consistency he's done it with over 3-4 years. I would still have Suarez individual season in 2014 up there with anything anyone has done in the Premier League. He was just devastating, but that bit of longevity from Mo Salah puts him at the top of the list out of those three and out of Liverpool attacking players of the Premier League era. The other reason why Salah maybe at times doesn't get all the love is that Virgil van Dijk was on the scene. And Virgil van Dijk was seen as the transformational figure for Liverpool in bringing them from being contenders to being champions. So it's not as if Salah stood out the way that Suarez did. Like, Suarez was comfortably the best player in that Liverpool squad. Fernando Torres obviously had Steven Gerrard alongside him, but I think
so did Suarez.
At their very best, I don't think Gerrard is quite at the same level as he did when Torres was there. But I think van Dijk in Liverpool's title-winning season was obviously Footballer of the Year. And maybe that overshadowed Salah a little bit, but I think for consistency, what he's done over the last 4 years, like Salah is in. Like, you have to think Salah's. You're probably trying to change the system for Liverpool's all-time greatest team, because it's always been Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush. Like, that's the front two in Liverpool's greatest ever side. Do you now need to sacrifice a midfielder to squeeze in Mo Salah there on the right-hand side?
It sounds like you are. So why did the Telegraph feel the need to write the piece saying that he's underappreciated? Is it because someone were making the arguments about the importance of the other two all the time?
I think it is. I think there was a lot of talk of the crucial role that Bobby Firmino played in linking the midfield and the attack, sort of the on-scene work that Firmino was so good at. And in terms of Liverpool's high press that is so key to them in everything they do, that Sadio Mane was the one who had that work ethic more than anybody else. And that sort of Salah, well, you're just reliant on the genius of Salah. You know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But I think it doesn't acknowledge the amount of players he drags away and creates space for Firmino and creates space for Mane, because he is the main threat and teams are aware of that. So Firmino's clearly had a massive dip. Mane isn't at the level he was a couple of seasons either, it feels like right now. And Salah is just getting better and better right now. So I think that conversation has come to an end. Maybe this has been leaked out by Mo Salah's people to start just putting it out there. It doesn't feel love. This is why he's got to go somewhere where they're really going to preach. Those fans in Paris, they know how to love somebody. See how many Lionel Messi jerseys they bought? They know how to respect somebody. Messi's contract's up the same summer my contract's up. This could work out beautifully.
What's the main replica jersey in Anfield at the moment?
Oh, I assume it's Salah. It's got to be Salah, I'd say, comfortably.
See, that's it. I wasn't really aware of this notion out there that there was a lack of appreciation for Mo Salah. Like, I think he's like right on course. He's probably going to win Golden Boot this year if you look at the early signs. So only three other people have won three Golden Boots, and it's Shearer, Henri and Harry Kane. And it seems even ridiculous that you have to make a case to put him in that category. But I think the weekend feels like a little bit of a watershed insofar as one game can be, where it's like, hold on a minute, anybody who didn't put this guy into the all-time greats in the Premier League, never mind Liverpool, you got to do it now.
Yeah, I think you do. And yeah, as I say, it's always the big games. Every big game Liverpool have played in over the last 3 or 4 years, Salah has delivered. It is, I think, harking back though to like what do you want? Like, how does he want to be loved? How do Liverpool supporters prove their love for Mo Salah? Like, is it the rivalries that are within the game that, like, Mo Salah now is never going to be acknowledged, because like, Manchester United supporters can never talk about Mo Salah because now we're so divided that you have to just talk down Liverpool at every opportunity, or talk down Manchester United at every opportunity, and Liverpool fans don't defend them enough when they get the opportunity. I don't know. I think there's a lot of love for Mo Salah. Like, maybe they need to put him way above Firmino and Mane and say, get rid of these guys, just keep Mo Salah. Like, it's, I don't fully get it, to be quite honest.
So, in your view, do the Liverpool hierarchy feel the same way, and will they spend the money that's required to keep Mo Salah at the club?
Yeah, I think they do. I'd be with Kenny Cunningham. Made a good comment of, like, Salah needs to be fair to the club as well, in that, you know, if they offer him 400 grand a year, take the 400 grand a year. Don't say I'm holding that for five, but a week. Don't say I'm offer him 400 grand a year. I'd say, lads, you're grand, thanks. 400 grand a week, take the 400 grand a week. They still have quite a bit of time to get this sorted out. There seems to be a bit of chat of maybe very early in the new year. It'll be a nice surprise for the Liverpool supporters. But you do, like Mark Lawrence was making the point of, or Pat Nevin, of, you know, how much money do you spend to replace Mo Salah?
Yeah, the only thing about that is that if they were to get Haaland and the replacement, like, you're getting a younger player who will, you will then, your succession line will go Torres, Suarez, Salah, Haaland, or Salah, Mbappe, and they're younger, and that's how this business works.
That's a different conversation. I think if that conversation is happening, then it is, you maybe say to yourself, well, we bring in one of them next summer and we leave Mo Salah and let him run down his contract, even have the two of them together for one season. But if, like, it still feels we're a bit away from, certainly a bit in contention for Mbappe or Haaland.
Yeah,
like, that's the caliber you need to replace Mo Salah, somebody who you can guarantee is going to score you 20 league goals a season at least, and is also going to score in every big game.
And there's on that topic, there's a report in Sport Bild this morning that Borussia Dortmund wants to double Haaland's wages to persuade him to stay at the club until 2023. Now, I mean, I'm not sure if that's going to be something that's successful or not, but if it is, then you are looking down the line, you're kind of going through till the end of next season before that actually becomes a possibility, and Mbappe is off the table at this point, which makes holding on to your asset even more essential, I would say, if those two kids are, well, like, you can't really call them kids anymore, are going to be unavailable certainly next summer.
Yeah, like, Liverpool could end up in a situation where they're signing Lautaro Martinez, you know, signing a new contract. Like, there's an element of risk involved to that. It feels as though Mbappe and Haaland are two of the only young strikers in world football where there's no real risk. Like, everybody expects Haaland, if he signs to someone in the Premier League, is going to score 25 Premier League goals. But that is a big investment, and that is every club in Europe wanting to sign Haaland. And is there a beauty and a magic to Liverpool that he looks at that takes him away from Manchester City? And the 100% guaranteed success you're going to have with City, like, Liverpool, you're also relying on, like, if you're Erling Haaland, the first thing you're asking if you're in a meeting with Liverpool is, how long is that guy staying for? And you're pointing at Jurgen Klopp. Like, that is the number one thing you want to know, because that will be the biggest decision, far greater than Mo Salah, is there a moment when Jurgen Klopp thinks, you know, I need a break. I want a couple of years out. I'm done with Liverpool. I've achieved everything I can possibly achieve. And that is the biggest threat to Liverpool over the next 4 or 5 years, far greater than Mo Salah even.
No, Stevie G will just step in and take the reins. Stevie G at the wheel, right?
Yeah.
It always works when you get a club legend back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Particularly when it's been successful up north.
Well, if you think it's, it's divisive at Manchester United with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, imagine what it would be like with Liverpool with Gerrard, where, you know, there'd be those who could look at it dispassionately and think, but this isn't working if it's not working. Whereas he is such a legend in so many people's eyes.
All right.
You could never fire Steven Gerrard.
Well, we'll see. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.